is the Leadership Momentum Podcast with Chris Brown.
Well, hello, leaders. Welcome to the July 2016 edition of the Leadership Momentum Podcast. Hope you had a fantastic July 4th weekend. I know my wife and I had a great time celebrating with our kids and lots of our friends. So thankful for a country where we can do that. And so thankful for a country where we can all, at our respective churches, we can all meet publicly and praise Jesus. I don't know if you kind of linked those two together this weekend, but we live in an amazing country, and what a great time of reflection this weekend was. This month's episode includes an in-studio conversation with Michael Hyatt and another outstanding conversation with the one and only Pastor Gene Apple. So I'm really excited about this episode and exactly the content that we're going to be talking about. So let's dive right in. We're going to start off with my chat with Michael Hyatt. If you're not familiar with Michael Hyatt, he is the New York Times bestselling author of Platform, Get Noticed in a Noisy World. Tons of accolades for that particular project. It's absolutely phenomenal, brilliant stuff. He's also the former chairman and CEO of Thomas Nelson Publishers, and recently he just finished a project that I thought that we need to discuss here on the Leadership Momentum Podcast. So whatever your context is, whether you're a high-level volunteer, maybe you're a lead pastor, somewhere in the middle, lean into this content and see how it applies to you right there, wherever you're at in your leadership journey. Enjoy. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me in studio today.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be with you.
Yeah, guys, obviously it's an honor to have Michael in the studio anytime or even on the phone to talk about his work. And many of you, maybe even all of you, are familiar with all the work that he's done over the years, and he's blessed us tremendously. His latest book is called Living Forward, A Proven Plan to Stop Drifting and Get the Life You Want. And you could throw in the word ministry if you want. Get the ministry life that you want. And he co-wrote that with Daniel Harkavy. But I wanted to have him in here today to talk about this whole idea of drifting. You might be listening in today as a ministry leader or a executive pastor or maybe campus pastor or lead pastor. I'm not sure what your role is or what denomination you're with, but this whole element of drifting, and you might automatically be drawn into thinking about ministry drift or vision drift, but maybe it's the drifting in your house. Maybe it's the drifting with your relationship with your spouse. I don't know what it is for you, but I really want to break this down. So, Michael, let's just start with the title of the book. You tell people to stop drifting. As leaders in the church, sometimes life can move at a really fast pace. Sometimes we get stuck in a routine also. It can be fast, we can get stuck in a routine. How do leaders that are serving the church start drifting?
Well, drifting is kind of the antithesis of living with intention. And I think people in ministry are particularly vulnerable to this because there's so many external demands. And if you're not careful, you can spend all of your time reacting to those demands instead of being intentional in designing your life and your ministry and fulfilling your calling. But Gail and I had been married about 10 years when we decided to go on a vacation to Hawaii. And we didn't have much money at that time, so we saved all of our nickels and dimes and we went to Hawaii. But when we got there, we didn't have a lot of money for entertainment. But the hotel we were staying at was offering snorkeling lessons for free. So we went to the swimming pool, got checked out. They took us out onto the reef. We were blown away by what we saw. So we found out that we could rent snorkeling equipment for about $10 for the entire week. So we rented the equipment. Next morning, we went to the lagoon that was adjacent to the hotel, and we got out and we started paddling around. I mean, it was just a beautiful day, crystal clear water, totally calm. We're looking at all these multicolored fish, the seaweed that was, you know, gently swaying in the sunlight. And we were captivated. We were distracted. And next time we looked up, about 45 minutes later, we'd been caught in a riptide and we'd been pulled really far out to sea. I don't know how far it was, but the hotel looked like a toy in the distance. So Gail looked up, she gasped. We had a boogie board, thankfully. She said, what are we going to do? And I said, we're going to swim for all of our might to get to the shore. And we did. And we finally pulled up about, I think it was about an hour later. And collapsed on the beach, and until last fall, we hadn't been snorkeling since. It was such a traumatic experience.
I bet.
But a lot of people are like that with their lives.
Yeah.
You know, people don't get up in the morning and say, you know, I think I'm going to wreck my health. I think I'll start overeating, eating a lot of junk food until I develop a heart problem and maybe I'll have a heart attack. Or they don't do that in their marriage. They don't just decide, you know, I'm going to destroy my marriage. Instead, they just get really busy. They stop dating. They stop investing in that relationship. And before long, they're really far apart. Same thing can happen in your ministry, you know, where you're just pulled in all these different directions, all these different factions, and you end up at a place that's not by design, but just the loudest voices in the church that are making you go to those places. But the opposite of the drift is to have a plan. And what we advocate in the book is creating a life plan. You know, people have financial plans, they have wedding plans, they have vacation plans, but to have a plan for your life, to me, that's the ultimate stewardship. It's not just our money. It's not even just our time or our talent. What God's after is our life. And we got to be intentional with that.
I know that snorkeling experience was a lot of the inspiration behind this book, but there's been some real personal moments in your life too that have kind of shaped this book too, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way I got into life planning, it was back in the year 2000, and I suddenly found myself promoted at Thomas Nelson Publishers, where I eventually became the CEO. But at that point, I was an assistant general manager. I got promoted to be the general manager of one of 14 divisions of the company. And it happened to be the division that was dead last in terms of revenue growth, profitability, every financial metric.
Uh-huh.
So the CEO said, how long is it going to take you to turn this around? And I picked a number out of the air. I said, probably about 3 years. And he said, fine. Well, I went back to the team and we got really busy and we were able to go from number 14 to number one in 18 months. That's the good news. The bad news is that it came at considerable cost, really to all of us, but especially to me, because I was on the road constantly. I started eating a lot of junk food. I stopped working out. My health kind of deteriorated until I ended up in the ER three times thinking I was having a heart attack, but it was just stress, thankfully. But my cardiologist said to me, he said, if you don't start changing something, you're going to end up in here for real. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to be much use to anybody, not my family or my company, if I have a heart attack. So I need to get this fixed. So I was talking to John Maxwell, who was one of my authors at the time, and I said, I really feel like I need some help. This is not sustainable.
Yeah.
And he said, you need to talk to Daniel Harkavy, who's my co-author on this book, who's an executive coach. I think he can help you. So the first thing that Daniel did was worked with me through creating a life plan. It wasn't this elaborate, you know, strategic plan that, you know, you put on the shelf and never look at, but it was a simple document, about 8 to 15 pages long. And it was something that I created, and I got really clear on what I wanted in the major categories of my life. You know, what would it look like to honor God in all those various, Daniel calls them life accounts, but with my health, with my marriage, with my career, with my finances. You know, and again, I think stewardship is all of those.
In the title, you got Living Forward, a proven plan to stop drifting and get the life that you want. It's kind of like you stop something and then there's this proactive life plan thing. But what would you tell the leader who he's listening in right now or she's listening in right now and she's like, I just don't have the time. I don't have the time to do a life plan.
Yeah, we get that a lot. And when we were doing the research for the book, one of the things we discovered is that the average bride preparing for a wedding, and I've got five daughters. I've been through this four times.
So you're
a
pro.
I can verify that this is true. The average bride spends 39 days planning a wedding that's going to last maybe an hour.
Oh, my goodness.
And then a reception that's going to last a couple of hours.
Yeah.
The average person in buying a new car spends 5 days in researching the new car.
Yeah.
You know, most of us spend a couple of weeks in planning a one-week vacation. So what we're saying is take one day. That's all, just one day.
Yeah.
If you can take one day and get your head above the clouds, kind of the 30,000 foot view on your life and say, where is this going? If I don't change anything in my life today, what's the trajectory look like?
Yeah.
You know, if I don't change my health habits, where is this going to end up? You know, people don't just have a bad health that's just given to them. I mean, I suppose there are things that happen. Mm. But a lot of times it happens because we're not good stewards over what we've been given.
Yeah.
Same thing in our marriage. You know, you end up in a bad marriage and maybe, you know, some people settle, some people get divorced, but we're stewards of that relationship. We don't have to settle. It can be improved. We can bring in outside resources, but we've got to get clear. And this is really important, Chris, clear on what we want.
Yeah.
Three times in the Gospels, Jesus asked someone, he says, what do you want me to do? Now, this is the Son of God. He knows what they need. Mm-hmm. But he asked them, what do you want me to do? Evidently, to him, their clarity is really important.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes God is asking us, what do you want in your marriage? Mm-hmm. What do you want for your health? And I think that once we get clear, then we can pray with passion.
Yeah.
You know, obviously we have to commit our ways to the Lord and he establishes our plan. There's got to be that priority. But sometimes we forget the planning part.
Well, you know, we oftentimes as church leaders, we throw around Proverbs 29:18, where there is no vision, the people perish. And we use that in context of the ministry that we're leading.
Right.
But how often are we actually living that out in our personal life? And you talk a lot about legacy in this book. And tell us a little bit about the importance of legacy and how important this vision for our life is.
It's critically important. We say in the book that self-leadership precedes team leadership. And this is vitally important for people in the ministry. Mm-hmm. Because more is caught than taught. When Jesus chose the disciples in Mark 3:14, it says he chose 12 that they might be with him. You know, it wasn't this public ministry that was the primary focus. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's easy to think that, that's what it is.
Yes.
But the way he changed the world and turned the world upside down was focusing on a handful of people with whom he shared his life. And if we're going to have a life that's compelling, it's going to take some planning. And we are going to leave a legacy. I think sometimes it's easy to think that, yeah, Winston Churchill left a legacy and Steve Jobs left a legacy and Margaret Thatcher left a legacy. But a legacy for all of us is inescapable. The only question is whether that legacy is going to be good or it's going to be bad. What's the ripple effect? What are people going to be left with when we're gone? And I think to be intentional about that as ministry leaders, and to live a life that's worth emulating. I mean, I love where the Apostle Paul says, follow me as I follow Christ. Yeah. Can we say that to the people we're leading? You know, if you want to know how to take care of yourself, how to take care of your family, just follow me and do what I do. That's what he was saying.
Yeah.
You know, can we say that? And I think that means that we've got to give intention to our lives and we've got to build, you know, the structure of our lives in a way that honors God and is worth emulating.
You know, in the book, you've got a step-by-step process that'll help us through this as leaders. And there's obviously very proven principles in there, but can you give us a little bit of a sneak peek into
Sure.
some of it?
Absolutely. So the book is around organized around three questions. And I think the questions that we ask ourselves are so important because mm-hmm. we can ask disempowering questions and we can ask really empowering questions. Like a disempowering question would be like, you know, why does bad stuff always happen to me?
Yes.
Yeah, it's not a fruitful question. But the first question we ask is, how do I want to be remembered? And this is the question of legacy. You know, we're not going to live forever. We're going to eventually die. And so we have an exercise that we take you through where we say, imagine your funeral was today. And the people on the front row were your family. And the people on the second row were your friends. And the people behind that were your colleagues and your friends. If they were the ones that were giving the eulogy or a series of eulogies, what would they say about you? Would it be something that you would be proud to hear or something where you kind of wince and go, oh, you know, I wished I could have made more of an impact. If only I'd spent more time, if only I'd given that more attention.
Yeah.
Well, the good news is once we take you through the exercise, we remind you that you're not dead yet. And Steve Jobs said in a commencement address at Stanford University, he said, death, this is kind of prophetic. It was 2 years before he died. He said, death is the single best tool I've ever discovered for helping make the big decisions in life. And so we take you through creating a series of legacy statements where you say, I want to be remembered. I want my wife to remember that, or I want my husband to remember that. Mm-hmm. I want my children to remember. How do you want to be remembered?
Yeah.
We can begin to engineer those memories today.
That's powerful. How do I want to be remembered? A lot of times we think about that question in the context of our team. How do I want my team to remember me? But the whole idea of this podcast is that we'd pull up a little bit and look at our life from 360 degrees, that we would look at our entire life, not just one portion of our life. And we can get so sucked into meetings and so sucked into our 40 hours that we don't look at the other 128 hours.
So often we can give attention to the ministry and not make our own personal spiritual lives a priority, our own walk with Christ, or our relationship with our spouses. You know, one of the things I've found in my own life is my marriage with Gail, we've been married for 37 years, it's like the most, one of the most powerful leadership tools I have. Because people look at our marriages and they say, so that's how he treats the people that are closest to him. Or that's how she treats the people that are closest to her. And so we're constantly modeling, you know, what it means to be in a relationship with us, to be in a relationship with God. And therefore, we've got to model our lives knowing that other people are going to emulate it. And I think that's why it's critically important to think about this issue of legacy.
Yeah, as I spend more and more time with you, I think about, you know, you've talked about question number one, how do you want to be remembered? But question number two talks about what matters most to you. And obviously, Gail comes up a lot when I'm talking to you, and that means a lot to you. And so walk us through that question. How do we ask that question, and how do we answer that question, and how do we let that question shape us and shape our behavior? What matters most to us?
This is a question, Chris, about priorities. Mm-hmm. And usually we know what's important to the other people in our lives. And if we're not careful, we live according to their priorities, because if you don't have a plan for your life, somebody else does, mm-hmm. right? You know, the people that are the leadership in your church, the people that are, you know, the best members, the people that are the weakest, you know, they've all got an agenda. But this is a question about what's important to you. And so for me, and what we do in the book is we help you come up with a list, and it might be different at different seasons in your life. For me right now, it looks like this. God is obviously my number one priority. Number two, and this is surprising to a lot of Christians, it's me. Not in a selfish way, not in a narcissistic way, but the point is, if I don't take care of myself, I'm not going to be of any use to anybody else. It's like when you fly in an airplane and the flight attendant says, you know, in the unlikely event that the cabin's depressurized, put on your own oxygen mask first before you attempt to help anybody else. Why? Because you'll be passed out if you don't do that. So if I have a heart attack, I'm not going to be of much use to my family, to my church, to my work, to anything else. If my marriage blows up, that's going to have serious repercussions in every area of my life. So for me, I'm number two.
Yeah.
But that's so I can serve.
Yeah.
Number three, Gail. Number four, my kids, my grandkids, my work, and all the rest flows after that. But this isn't just like some, you know, arbitrary, ethereal thing. It's a real practical thing.
Yeah.
So back in the midst of the recession, I think the year was about 2009. I mean, we were doing hand-to-hand combat, trying to survive as a company. Again, this, I was CEO of Thomas Nelson Publishers. Our industry was being affected like so many businesses were. And I desperately needed a vacation. I'd gone way too long without one, so I cleared it with the board. Gail and I decided we're going to go to Colorado and spend a week in the wilderness completely unplugged. We had to change planes in Dallas, and when I landed, I made the mistake of checking email. And I had a message from the chairman of the board, and he said, hey, change of plans. We're going to be in your office on Monday, and I'd be grateful if you'd be there. And my heart sank, because we had planned this, we had dreamed about it, and we needed it. We needed it for our own health, for rest, and for one another. So I showed it to Gail, and I mean, you can just see the color drain from her face. And she said, honey, look, this is a tough decision. I'll support you no matter what you decide, but, you know, I'm with you. So I wrote back to the chairman and I said, look, I'm going to go ahead to Colorado, as I told you, and as I cleared with the board before. I'd really be grateful if you'd postpone this meeting, but if you do come in, my staff will help you. So then I unplugged, and I checked when I got back, and I asked my staff, did they come in? Yes, they came in. What was it about? They couldn't hardly remember. It was just like, we could have handled this via email. So I almost scuttled my vacation. But the only reason I didn't was because I had a clear set of priorities. It wasn't easy.
Yeah.
It took some courage. But the thing that priorities do is give us the courage in the moment to say no to the things that matter less so that we can say yes to the things that matter more.
Yeah.
And life is kind of a zero-sum game in that way. Every time I say yes to an outside demand, I'm going to have to say no to something else. And oftentimes, that's a no to somebody in my family. And, you know, I'm not saying that there aren't times when that's totally legitimate. I'm just saying we've got to be clear that we're doing it intentionally. And we're doing it by design and not by default.
You had said that priority number one for you is God. And I think as ministry leaders and pastors, we can get a little confused at that priority number one, that it's the church.
Yes.
There's a big difference. You know, God and your relationship with God is number one. That doesn't necessarily mean that that noisiest attendee in the church is priority number one. And sometimes we can get that confused when we're answering emails at 2 a.m. and those kind of things. Now, in the book, you talk a lot, you take this legacy to another level, and you talk about eulogies. Very powerful concept. Talk to us a little bit about how we can look at our eulogies.
Yeah, I think it's two parts. It's one is the eulogy is what people would say today, yeah. And oftentimes there's a gap, between what they would say and what we would want them to say. Mm-hmm. And that's where we come to the legacy statements, where we can begin to engineer this idea and begin to think about, the memories we're trying to create.
Yeah.
So when my father-in-law died in 2005, he was a full Air Force colonel. They had a full military funeral for him. It was an incredible, unforgettable experience, really. The jets flying over, 21-gun salute, all that. But what was more unforgettable was going back to my house afterwards with all the family and the friends, and for hours looking through pictures and telling stories about my father-in-law and what he meant to us. And we laughed and we cried. And I realized then and there that we can begin today to engineer those memories. Mm. What is it that I want my kids to remember about me?
Yeah.
What is it that I want my wife to remember when I'm gone? What is it that I want the people I work with? And for me, I'm very active in social media. I think even, what do I want my followers to remember when I'm gone? And so constructing a series of legacy statements, we walk you through the whole process step by step, gives you enormous clarity about the end of your life. Where is all this going? And how can I be a faithful steward over what God's put into my hands today?
You've got an example in your book of a eulogy that's pretty powerful. You and I are talking a little bit about that eulogy, and I thought it would be really powerful if you read that for us.
Yeah, here's one actually from Karen, who's a stay-at-home mom. We give a lot of examples in here, some from our own lives, but Karen said this. She said, I want Gary to remember that he was always my very best friend. I want him to remember how much he trusted me and how I always supported, valued, and encouraged his dreams and aspirations. I want him to remember what a powerful partnership we had and how our individual talents complemented our incredible marriage. I want him to remember how absolutely attracted we were to each other physically, mentally, and emotionally, and how we always worked to fulfill each other's needs.
And folks, as you listen into that, and it's just powerful for me to even watch Michael reading that, because there's something in that that we all cling to, that we all like, oh my goodness, I want that to be me so bad. And we're doing so much good work. Oh, there's so many being saved and so many being baptized, and God's doing it all, but he's using us, everyday people, to carry on his plan A, the local church. But my question for you is, are you doing all that work, but still not looking your kids in the eye when you talk to them, or looking at your spouse in the eye when you're talking to them? Are we distracted? Are we drifting? And this book, again, is called Living Forward, A Proven Plan to Stop Drifting and Get the Life That You Want. Michael, thank you so much for your work, and thank you so much for everything you poured into our community. On behalf of the entire church leadership community, thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, what a great encouragement that was. The big takeaway there was, we must be purposeful in our plans so that we're not drifting. I love his illustration of drifting in the ocean. It's all happened to us before, where we've kind of been drifting out there and we're like, oh shoot, we're all the way down the coastline. And that definitely happens in our life. And, people don't decide to destroy their health or their marriage or their leadership career or professional journey on purpose, right? We just drift. And I don't know where you're at in your leadership. I don't know if you're stuck in a rut, but I pray that that content was really powerful in your life and that you can apply something that you heard today. I really appreciate Michael being so vulnerable. Those personal moments that have shaped this book for him and shaped his life, his health and family concerns that he shared. And I just know for me recently, I noticed that my kids are getting less and less spiritually sensitive. I've got an 11-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 7-year-old. And right now, they're in a season where I feel like, they're just distracted by, I don't want to say the world, but kind of distracted by culture and a little bit less intrigued by the church. And I looked into my leadership And I asked, why is this happening? And I kind of paid attention to what we're watching on TV and what they're listening to on the radio. And we have gotten a little bit further away from just listening to all, uplifting music. And we've gotten to some music that's a little bit more fun. And there's a fun part of that. But I feel like they're getting less and less sensitive. And what's happening is that this radar went off this weekend in my mind and in my heart that we're drifting. As a family, we're drifting away from being super sensitive to spiritual things, and nothing real bad. My kids aren't like cussing up a storm or anything or going off the deep end or anything like that, but there's just a little bit less sensitivity to spiritual things. They're getting a little bit calloused to the pain in this world, and we're drifting. And so, you know, Michael Hyatt says opposite of a drift is to have a plan. And so now, you know, the stations on the dial are a little bit different in our cars. We put together some systems that are going to help us get back on track, but we've got to have a plan. And so really, really powerful stuff. And, you know, one area that it's no secret that I'm very passionate about is this area of stewardship. And as I talk to leaders around the country, what I'm noticing is everyone values it. But many have actually drifted in their leadership when it comes to leading through the area of stewardship. A lot of them would say, man, we'd love to do more about stewardship in our church, but it's just not part of our culture. Well, the culture wasn't always that way. It must have drifted. And we would love at Ramsey Solutions to help with that. And of course, change in your church, it starts with you. It starts with the leader. If you're the leader of the church, if you're the leader of the ministry, it starts with you. It starts with your leadership team. And our team here at Ramsey Solutions would love to connect with you on how we can help when it comes to stewardship. So maybe it's putting your entire staff and their spouses through Financial Peace University. Maybe it's your church needs to kind of a whole reset button on finances in general and consider putting everyone in your church through Financial Peace University. Something to get them more spiritually sensitive when it comes to stewardship. So all you got to do is get in touch today with our team by calling 866-357-3283, or you can email us at chrisbrownonair@stewardship.com. That's chrisbrownonair@stewardship.com. Well, we're all ready for our second interview on this episode. We've got Pastor Gene Apple, and he is the lead pastor out at Eastside out in Anaheim, California. Before that, he was at Willow Creek as their lead pastor of their South Barrington campus. And before that, he was the lead pastor out at Central Christian in Las Vegas. So decades of experience, and I know he's gone through some big transitions in his journey. And so I wanted to explore that a little bit. And he's going to join us now to talk about transitions, how to transition well. And if you are one of the current people that are in an organization and somebody transitions in and is now leading you, how do you handle that well? Great conversation, and I know you'll enjoy it. Folks, this is Pastor Gene Apple. Pastor Gene, thank you so much for joining us here today on the Leadership Momentum Podcast. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Chris. And I'm just honored to be here, honored to talk with you, talk with leaders, and I'm thrilled about your new radio show, too. I've gotten to listen to it several times, and I know it's blessing a lot of people, so way to go.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Now, you know, of course, I've followed your journey throughout the years and been a big student all the way from the time when you were at Willow. But just for those who are listening, why don't you give us a brief overview of your ministry journey? And because you've been a lot of just a variety of geographic regions and different styles when it comes to church. So give us a brief overview.
Yeah. So when I was 25 years old, I'd grown up in the Midwest, lived there all my life. And at 25 years old, I became senior pastor at Central Christian Church in Las Vegas, and where Jed Wilhite is now and doing such a fantastic job. And when I went to Central, they were a church of about 450 people, very ingrown, very gray-haired, very traditional. And we went through a leadership kind of journey together as a church and really transitioned toward being a church that was outward-focused rather than inward-focused, really focused on reaching the people who were the furthest from God. And spent the next 18 years of my life there thinking I was going to be there the rest of my life, to be honest with you. And loved Las Vegas, met my wife in Las Vegas. All our kids were born there. But in 2003, at the invitation of Bill Hybels, I went to Willow Creek and became lead pastor of their South Barrington campus there, and spent 5 fantastic years in Chicago, learned a lot, worked with some fantastic people, but I just felt like I really wasn't inside my calling. I felt like God had fundamentally wired me to be a senior pastor of a local church. And so in 2008, kind of began looking and praying about what's next. God, you know, what do you have for me? And I ended up coming to Eastside Christian Church, which then was in Fullerton, California. We relocated 3 years ago to Anaheim to a new campus. And interestingly enough, I had interned at Eastside when I was 20 years old, back in 1993, back in the day. And it was a church that had really marked my life in a great way. I had interned here for 7 months. And so being able to come back in 2008 to kind of lead Eastside into a next chapter. The church was at that time 46 years old, and it had begun in 1962. And so, but it was really ready for a next chapter and positioned for a next chapter.
Mm-hmm. So when I hear your story, I automatically am drawn to this whole element of you've become a master at change. Either implementing change or dealing with change, and obviously our listenership is right in the middle of that, wherever they're at. They've got some kind of element of change. One of the things you hit on was inward versus outward. Explain what inward means, outward means, and what are some good takeaways that our listeners can have on how to steer something from inward to outward? You're a pro at that.
Well, I wear glasses, but sometimes I wear contact lenses. And a while back, I was having some trouble when I would put my contact lenses in my eyes. Everything was fuzzy and blurry. I'd get up to speak in church services. I couldn't read my notes. I couldn't read my Bible. And it was really frustrating. And I thought, I wonder what's causing that. And then one Saturday night before service, it hit me. I thought, I wonder if I've gotten my lenses switched, and the one that's supposed to go in my left eye, I'm putting them in my right eye, and the one that's supposed to go in my right eye, my left eye. And I thought, well, you know, what the heck? I just switched them around. And it was amazing how much better I could see. I saw things with new precision and new clarity. And I was thinking about that. I think this is what happens to churches over time. We get our lenses switched, and instead of outward focus, we're inward focus. Instead of being an inclusive kind of community, we become an exclusive kind of community. And what's imperceptive to most of us, if it happens slowly, it happens gradually over time, and we don't even realize that it's happening until one day we wake up and we realize, hey, we're kind of all in the family here, and we've lost our evangelistic edge. And I think the evangelism value for people who are far from God is the value that leaks the fastest in a local church. Mm. Because if we're in the church and we're already know Christ and have a relationship with Him and we're saved, you know, we're not thinking about creating ministries and or programs or approaches or strategies to reach those who are far from Him. We're just thinking about ourselves. Mm. And so that value really falls fast. And I've even quantified it. I think if you're not doing something to raise the evangelistic value in your church every 30 days, it's going to slip off people's radar real fast.
Wow. That's true. I mean, the natural instinct is just to pull towards what's comfortable. But if you're reaching new people and they're coming in, you're going to be every week's going to have this uncomfortable kind of feeling. And so we're naturally gravitating away from that. That's what I hear you saying.
Yeah. And I've even kind of developed I'm going to make a statement that you're probably going to say you should be sued for pastoral malpractice for making that statement, but I really believe it's true. And one of the things I've experienced here at Eastside over the last 7 years that I've been the pastor here is in order to reach more people, we've had to do less ministry. Mm. And most people hear that and they think, what? To reach more people, you do less ministry. But it's absolutely true. Most churches that a leader is going to go into, the majority of churches are not church plants. They're existing churches or an existing organization. And organizations over time, the longer they exist, more systems get put into place, more processes get into place, more programs get put into place, and it just kind of starts weighing it down. And like for instance, when I came to Eastside, I got some of our staff together in a room. We were a church of about 1,900 at the time, down from a high of about 3,000 in its heyday about 10 years earlier. And I got some of our staff in the room, and I said, I want you to help me to understand what are all the different programs that we have to help adults grow spiritually. And so I started listing them on a flip chart. I'm the new pastor here trying to get the lay of the land. And there weren't 5 programs, there weren't 10, there weren't 20, there weren't 30, there were 32 different programs in our church of 1900 to help adults grow spiritually. Mm. Well, when you're running 32 different programs and you've got resources going to that and you've got energy going to that and leadership going to that, you can love your neighbor in your heart. You want to love your neighbor, but you don't have time to love your neighbor. And so we just kind of came to the conclusion, we're going to have to do less ministry in order to reach more people, because we're spending so much time on these programs that we don't even have time to get to know our neighbors, to engage in our community, to build relationships with those who need to know Jesus Christ. That's been a real key turning point for us, I think, at Eastside, in changing the momentum from a inward-focused church to an outward-focused church. We had to create margins in people's lives so that they could be outward-focused rather than being involved in church stuff, 5, 6, 7 days a week.
Yeah, and a lot of those ministries probably had like 3 people participating. And it's, I've heard John Maxwell say before, if it's a dead horse, dismount. And
you had that, and then you also had people participating in multiple ministries, which they don't need. Overfed and under utilized by God they're just involved in getting fatter and fatter at the spiritual trough.
Now, you had hit on a minute ago that you were a new pastor and you were learning the lay of the land, is what you said. How about some advice on what to do when you're inheriting a new ministry, whether it's in plateau or decline or thriving, whatever, but maybe not just a lead pastor, but you're any kind of ministry leader, you're coming in and you're inheriting this new ministry. What are some things to do?
Yeah, well, I always think about the process of leading through change or transition like a gardener or a farmer planting seed. And, there's going to be 4 phases of that. First, you're going to prepare the soil before you ever plant a seed. And then the second stage is you're actually going to plant a seed, that you want to see something happen. Mm-hmm. And then third, after you plant, you don't go right toward the harvest. You have to go through a time of watering and fertilizing, cultivating. Maybe there's some weeds that you got to pull. And then finally, there's going to be the harvest. And a lot of times, as leaders of anything, we want something to happen now, and we're impatient, and we want it to happen from the get-go. So we go right to planting the seed before we prepare the soil, or we plant the seed and want to experience the harvest but don't realize, hey, there's going to be a season of cultivating and fertilizing and watering this so it can take root and really grow. And so in my mind, it's the battles are won or lost on the kind of that first and third stage of preparing the soil and then being patient and cultivating it while it grows. So when I came into Eastside, there was I would say this would be the same when I went to Central in Las Vegas too. There's a time before you initiate a lot of major change where you're just preparing the soil. What would that involve? Well, that would be getting key leaders and influencers together and dreaming together, praying together, thinking about the future together. What could God do? What does the Holy Spirit want to do fresh among us in our ministry for the next step? I think the preparing of the soil, if you're a new leader in an environment, you want to understand the history well. and you want to understand the past. One of the things I think that gave me a leg up when I came to Eastside was I had served here many years ago as an intern and had maintained relationship with the church. So I already had some understanding, pretty good understanding of the history of the church and the different eras and relationships with some of the key leaders. So I think there's some of that understanding of the past. There's the dreaming and envisioning about the future. And then there's also, I would describe it as you have to understand, you need some measurables, to look at some measurables about where are we not hitting it out of the park? Where could we do better? Because there's no urgency to change anything if you don't understand there are some issues and some challenges. And it's important to look at what some of the issues are without in any way dishonoring the past, but trying to give, leaders declare reality, and you have to understand, here's where we are right now. And like when I came to Eastside, the church had been on a decline for 10 years. We had to be honest about that. Mm-hmm. And we had to be honest about the fact that we'd only had 56 baptisms that year. Now, that may sound like the day of Pentecost in a lot of church settings, but for a church of 1,900 people, mm-hmm, that has 5.8 million people who live within 20 miles of our church here in Southern California, I thought, surely heaven wants us to do better than that.
Right.
And so we had to talk honestly about some of those things. On the positive side, when I got to Eastside, they had not been through any church splits. There was a spirit of unity. It was a prayerful church. They had $6 million in the bank. We've solved that. So the church was positioned, I think, for a new future, mm-hmm, but it did need a new future. So, that getting together, dreaming, being a little dissatisfied with the way things are, getting people on the same page, that was really important. I initiated a kind of a strategic planning process in my early months at Eastside, and when you're new somewhere, you can do that. People are looking to you for leadership. They're going to, you do get a honeymoon period when you're the new leader in the environment. And so we started thinking about the future, and we did it in community. And then there were just some little things visibly, like, well, I didn't make wholesale changes to what we were doing in our services or things like that initially.
Yeah.
I just made sure we were doing everything with intentionality.
Okay.
And we were doing it with the highest level of quality and excellence that we could. Our facility as a church was... it had a lot of deferred maintenance issues and things that hadn't been done for many years. And within my first 3 months, we repainted, recarpeted, and refurnished all of our public spaces in our hallways, et cetera, with current colors and et cetera. And it just was an indication, hey, this is a new day.
Yeah.
And that, I've had people tell me that physical change in our campus really helped instill spiritual and leadership changes, like, hey, we're headed toward a new day. And people were ready for that. So those are some of the things I've learned about that initial moving ahead. And I've also learned, too, as you start to initiate some new things, two magic words that help everybody breathe kind of a sigh of relief is when you say trial basis. We're going to try this on a trial basis.
It's an experiment.
We'll do it for 6 months. We'll give it plenty of time, and if it doesn't work, we'll all feel better. You can all feel better that we're going to take another run at it, and we're not going to continue this if it doesn't produce fruit. But and everybody breathes a little easier on a trial basis.
It doesn't seem as long term. Well, you hit like so much gold there. Let me just rewind a little bit. I love the fact that you put highest level of excellence, and here's the key phrase, those of you who are listening, that you could. The highest level of excellence that you could. And so don't just hear the highest level of excellence. It's that you can. And so that's different for all of us. I love the fact that you said get small wins. You didn't actually use those words, but you said changes in the environment or little small changes. While you're preparing the soil, you're still you're still where you could and where you know you're not going to disrupt any kind of trust or come in too fast, you're still getting those small wins. I think that's huge.
Can I lean into that one just a little bit more? Like some of the early things that I did in my first 3 months, in addition to the physical changes, was I looked for some opportunities where I could add real pastoral value into people's lives through our services. What could be memorable? What could they take away and say, wow, you know, God really showed up to my life in a very significant way. So there was that. And then the other thing that I knew, I started on October 1st at the church, and I knew, you know, in less than 3 months, we have Christmas.
Yeah.
And I was just determined we were going to have the greatest Christmas outreach the church had ever seen. And we worked hard, and we ended up, you know, this was a church of 1,900 at the time. We had over 6,200 in our Christmas services. Mm. And that right there was just such a catalyst to a new day. It was that early win, and everybody was just shaking their heads going, oh man, God is doing something new and fresh in our church. And they're just started to believe that belief, that faith, that it's a new day.
Yeah, but I mean, that didn't happen on accident. Obviously, God has handed on it. But what you're saying is that you're, I think you said, reaching out for opportunities, pastoral opportunities, which really what that means is you are building up relational equity with people. I mean, you're pouring into people, and you had relational change with a lot of people to mobilize them for Christmas. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's important during that phase when you're new somewhere to, like, I think I booked, like, every breakfast, lunch, and dinner that I could in those early months just to build that relational equity with the key influencers in the church. I mean, one of the things I've learned over the years is it's not how many people embrace change and new initiatives that determines whether they succeed or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's who embraces those change and initiatives that determines whether they succeed or not. And so when you're spending time with key influencers in an organization or in a church or whatever it may be, they're going to be the ones that influence everybody else. And that's really what's going to determine whether new initiatives are embraced or not.
Yeah. So let's do this. You said prepare the soil, then plant a seed, watering, all these different phases. Let's break this down a little bit. Let's just say there's a campus pastor or associate pastor who just got assigned a campus, a large campus. Let's say it's about 3,000 or 4,000 people, and they're coming in and they've been there for a couple months. How do you weigh whether it's time to start planting seeds or not, or if you're still preparing soil? I don't want anyone to hear, hey, I'm just preparing soil, and they're doing that for, you know, 6 to 8 months. What's a good line? What's some good things that you can think through to know that you're ready to start planting seeds?
Yeah. Well, I think there's probably multiple layers of these things going on at once. There's some early seeds of change that are that you can start planting that aren't necessarily going to be cause the church to have to rethink everything strategically about their future.
Mm-hmm.
You can make incremental change in your services. This may sound funny, but it was low-hanging fruit. We changed our service times after I got here, about 3 months after I'd been here, and we adjusted them by a half hour, and they didn't realize how the former service times were kind of hurting them.
Gotcha.
And we just got better times.
Mm.
Well, that was a change we initiated. It was low key. There wasn't fallout from it. There was immediate fruit from it. And it was just some low hanging fruit.
Yeah.
So you can start initiating those kinds of things. But if you're at a campus and you're thinking about taking it in a dramatic new direction that's going to redefine the future, I think you're going to need, probably a good 6 months of soil preparation for defining some of those long-term kinds of things. And that's basically, we went through a strategic planning process, and it was about 4 months of strategic planning. Then it was a month of kind of reorienting our staff toward that. And then by month six, we were casting that vision to the entire congregation. And that was where, you know, some dramatic changes were going to come. This was when we start, you know, 32 different programs are going to go down to 3.
Right.
That's a dramatic change.
Yeah.
And So we cast that in a four-week series. And one of the things, I mean, as a younger leader, I wish I had been more wise and discerning on some of this. You know, and when I was like in my 20s, early 30s, you know, if I had a new vision, new initiative, I would just stand up kind of by myself without doing lots of soil preparation with key leaders in the church and hope that everybody would embrace it. And the sheer, you know, excitement of the vision itself, people would embrace. But I've learned you can get further faster by taking the time to process it with key people.
Yeah.
Making sure they're on board. So, for instance, when 6 months into this, we're casting this new vision for the church at the end of my first message of that series that day, and knowing that everybody would feel like, hey, this is going to be a little wobbly for us. These are some new things. This is going to be change for all of us. At the end of my message, I said, hey, you know, I know you probably all think, Gene, you're just loony. You're just a loony pastor. And I said, you know what? You're probably right. I am. But I want you to know I'm not the only loony person in this church. And I invited all of our staff and our church elder board and some members who had been on a strategic planning team to join me on the stage. And I said, there were probably about 35 people on the stage with me at that point. And I said, I want you to know these people here, they're loony too. And we have been in this process together for the last 6 months, asking God to lead us, asking God to direct us. And I said, I had my assistant this week do the math. Represented on this stage right now are 688 years of connection in this church.
Wow.
And I said, these people love this church. They would never do anything to hurt this church. And as best we can discern, this is where God is leading us. And we're asking you to join arms with us, join hearts with us. Let's move forward on this vision together. And, you know, I mean, by doing that, by having that unity of our leadership going into that vision cast, when we hit some headwinds and speed bumps, as you're naturally going to hit as you're making change ahead, our leadership was unified, and they were solid, and I didn't have to start worrying about, you know, division in the key leadership ranks. And of course, people in the church, they all knew somebody on that stage, you know, whether it was a staff member, a board member, or multiple people on that stage. They would have people they could go talk to, they could process some of the changes with, they could, or they could even say, hey, you know, if Tim's in favor of this, and if Julie's in favor of this, then I ought to be in favor of it too, or at least I can go talk to them about it. So I think that was a pretty powerful moment in at a very defining time in our church, as we are actually moving toward a new day. We are planting a new seed, because that was a whole new direction. That wasn't just incremental changes that we were planting. That was a kind of a declarative, we're moving ahead in a new direction.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're making these big changes and moves, you know, there's some folks who are, well, they're not making the change. You're making the change. So what are some practical tips for church leaders who are hearing you cast this vision for this big change or small change? What are some tips for them to be able to handle this?
Well, first, as an awareness, I think you have to realize the major roadblocks for people that they're going to have with the change are going to be emotional. Usually it's attachment, it's, you know, emotions that are attached to the familiar, et cetera. So we tried to make it permissible to talk about our emotions and to process those emotions. And, you know, people will tend to think the worst in the absence of information. So lots of information, lots of communication, understanding people will process these initiatives in different ways, you know. And I mean, we've all heard the old saying, you know, 10% are going to embrace anything new, 10% are going to oppose anything new, and the challenge is going to be to move that 80% in between.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. And certainly when we moved in a new direction, there were some people that we lost, and there were some people who didn't embrace that. The challenge is not the last 10%. The challenge is the 80% in the middle.
Yeah.
And being responsive to them. I mean, one thing I always tell church leaders, I said, here's something after being in church leadership for 30 years, I can tell you that you are going to have people leave your church. You are. Just accept that. You're going to have people leave your church if you don't make changes. You're going to have people leave your church if you do make changes. Mm. We get to decide what people are going to leave over.
That's so
you're
good.
You're going to have people leave your church. That's just the nature of the beast. So the challenge is, I think, creating environments that people can talk, express their emotions, acknowledge that, and then after listening, being courageous enough to move ahead. And, you know, once in a while, there's wisdom in taking three steps forward and one step back.
Mm.
You know, sometimes you step out, you know, a long distance to something new that you've never done before, and people are, like, very uncomfortable out there. And sometimes a wise, discerning leader will say, hey, if we take a step back, maybe that would kind of help everybody emotionally right now process this. And everybody goes, phew, you know, that feels a lot better. Thank you.
Yeah.
And you as the wise leader know, hey, I'm two steps further ahead than we used to be.
Yeah.
And then over time, you take another three steps forward and maybe a step or two back and three steps forward. And really over time, you realize we've done this enough. We're just a different church, and we're or a different organization or a different company, and we're in a different place today than we used to be.
You have gone to organizations that are either plateaued or declining. You know what that feels like. Of course, over 30 years, you've been part of ministries during seasons that were plateaued or declined. Actually, for over 30 years, very little, but you did experience it from time to time. What would be an encouraging word that you'd have for leaders listening in now? And they're right there in the middle of it. Again, I don't want to be naive of who's listening. The research shows that there are many churches that are in plateau or decline. So yeah. I want to make sure that we encourage them before we hang up.
I think as many as 80% of our churches are plateaued or declining.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, one of the things that causes me to lose sleep at night these days and to be a great burden to me is the fact that, you know, we got 80% of our churches that are stuck.
Mm-hmm.
when our world needs light and hope and Jesus more than ever. And, you know, I don't want to over-spiritualize the conversation, but I don't want to minimize the spiritual side of this.
Yeah.
And to say, hey, there's just a prayer component to this thing.
Mm-hmm.
When you're stuck, you just kind of need to pray a two-word prayer and say, you know, what now?
Mm.
God, what now? What's the fresh wind that you want to blow? What's that? And, you know, I believe, Chris, that when you get teams of people praying that prayer together and then earnestly putting themselves in a place to listen to God, you provide an avenue for the Holy Spirit to start to stir and to bring conversation and eventually unity around the next chapter of what God wants to do. I think that's a very important thing. And then another thing that I would suggest for those who are in that stuck place right now is to get outside of the bubble of your own existing ministry and to have conversations, visit other leaders, visit churches where there was a church who came to a similar stage that you're at now, and somehow they blew past it. And start looking at them. Well, you know, how did they turn it around?
Mm-hmm.
What were components of their story? What's happening there that can be applicable to us? You know, get outside of yourself. And I always, you know, share with church leaders, you can get more done in 2 or 3 days by getting some of your key people away in a car and going visiting another church or going to some conferences where you're just having sustained time together than sometimes you can get done in 2 or 3 years in meetings.
If you feel stuck today, pastors, just want you to know that want to take time out in this podcast to give you that encouraging word of some things that you can do. And want to make sure that you leave this podcast being encouraged. Pastor, we really, really appreciate your time, your experience. You have been all over the country and ministering to thousands of people. And for you to spend 30 minutes with us today, we're very, very thankful.
Well, thanks, Chris. And I just want all the listeners to know, I mean, I'm going to end this podcast just in my own heart and mind, just spending some time praying for all who are going to listen to it. And for those who feel stuck today or who feel discouraged or who feel like giving up, just that they'll be encouraged to remember, you know, they'll reap a harvest if they don't give up, and the stakes are sky high. And I'm just so thankful and proud for those who are courageous enough to lead their churches into a new chapter.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pastor, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet, Chris.
All right.
Until next time.
Well, another encouraging conversation, not only with Michael Hyatt, but also with Pastor Gene Apple. Folks, I hope that you've been encouraged today on the Leadership Momentum podcast. Just a reminder, we want to help you not only on this podcast, but we also want to help you with your stewardship needs. If you are interested in not drifting, but having a plan for your stewardship culture at your church, contact us at 866-357-3283. Again, 866-357-3283, or you can email me at chrisbrownonair@stewardship.com. Again, chrisbrownonair@stewardship.com. Leaders, thank you so much for being so serious about not drifting, but having a plan for the kingdom's benefit. God, thank you for these leaders. I pray, God, that you'd have your hand of protection upon them. And as they have written down several of these things to apply to their professional journey, I pray, God, that you give them the courage and the strength to be able to apply them. In Jesus' name, amen. God bless y'all.
Thanks for joining us for the Leadership Momentum Podcast with Chris Brown, brought to you by Ramsey Solutions. If you'd like to learn how other leaders are reclaiming biblical stewardship, head over to stewardshipcentral.org. Loved what you heard today and didn't want to miss another episode? Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. While you're there, share your feedback by leaving a review. Finally, stay up to date with Chris Brown, including his daily radio show and podcast, Chris Brown's True Stewardship, on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram by following @ChrisBrownOnAir. On behalf of your host, Chris Brown, and the team at Ramsey Solutions, thanks for joining us for the Leadership Momentum Podcast.